tu listening speaking en todo momento. 3 meses de los que subirás ese nivel tanto que, pues, que querrás otros 3 meses y otros 3. Entra en grupobauan.com e infórmate. Curso trimestral de Bauan. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on this program, I'm going to talk a little bit about the colonization of the southern part of North America. On other programs, I talked about the Pilgrims, the Puritans that established themselves up north in Massachusetts. I have spoken about the Dutch, right, coming from the Netherlands, who initially established themselves in New Amsterdam, and later that became New York. I have spoken about Virginia and all of the problems that that had, the difference between the charter colonies formed by corporations, right, kind of a privatization. Later on, of course, the crown, the royal authority had to take control in many of these cases, but at least initially charter colonies, proprietary colonies owned by one person, and one particular colony, completely different from the others, completely different, was founded not from England itself, but rather from the Caribbean. The initiative was taken in the Caribbean. Now, of course, the Spanish had taken over the Caribbean, most of it, and treated it as a kind of Mare Nostrum, at least initially. Then they established themselves on the islands, the Greater Antilles. But there's a kind of a barrier. You can see it going in a large curve, if you look at the map, of little islands called the Lesser Antilles. And the English established themselves on one of these islands in the Lesser Antilles, Barbados. And Barbados began as a sort of a plantation farm for food, for provisions, for ships and, you know, other people who were willing to pay for that, for food. But then, of course, then you got sugar. All of a sudden, sugar came. This was a benchmarking, adopting the best practices of your rivals. And the Portuguese were doing so well with plantations, sugar plantations, using African slaves. They had been doing this in the Madeira Islands, right, off the coast of Portugal. And they had extended this. The Spanish began to do it in the Canary Islands. And it was just a question of adopting this to the Caribbean. It was going to be the reason for all of this transcontinental exploration. Without sugar, there would be no European presence in the Americas. Without sugar, there would be no African presence in the Americas. The whole idea of this transcontinental migration, all of this was about sugar. And so the British thought, well, it's high time, right? It's high time that we do this for ourselves. And so they established themselves in Barbados, and Barbados immediately became successful, enormously successful, enormously. After a while, there were many, many, many more slaves than there were free people, and many more Africans than there were Europeans. After a while, Barbados was practically monoculture, right? What happened in Barbados is what had already happened in the Madeira Islands, right? You see, you hear Madeira and you think that there are going to be woods on those islands. Well, no, only sugar, right? After a while, they cut down all the trees and the Madeira Islands no longer had any wood in them. The same thing happened in Barbados, and land became more and more valuable and scarcer. And so it was time to expand. And they decided to expand to the North American coast. And this is why Carolina was created. And Carolina started as a Barbados-style plantation economy. Now, sugar did not grow well there, right? If sugar had grown well there, the history of the United States would have been completely different, completely different. But sugar was not an appropriate crop, cultivo, for that land. And they began to grow rice and indigo and other things, but not with slaves. But not. And then the northern part of that colony, that was not apt for plantation economy either. And after a while, they just separated. And so today you have a North Carolina and a South Carolina. The economy is completely different. The kind of people living there, completely different. So here you had the Carolinas, and you had that in an area which traditionally had been considered Spanish. And the Spanish were in Florida, and there was going to be a problem. You know, geopolitically, confrontation was inevitable. Now, what happened? Well, the Spanish, little by little, began to establish themselves in Florida and to get ready. There had been other attempts, for example, missions, right, in what is today the Carolina, in the Chesapeake, as far north as what is later going to be Virginia. But this was much, much too far from the administrative center of Mexico City. And, yeah, things, also people had very fuzzy notions, very indistinct notions, very erroneous notions of geography back then. Right? They established a colony in Florida believing that it could be, that provisions could arrive from Zacatecas in Mexico. And we're talking about 2,500 kilometers, right? But they thought, no, it's going to be easy. We've already established ourselves in Zacatecas. No, the notions of geography were just, they were not working at all. The Spaniards who established themselves in the Chesapeake Bay believed that quite possibly if they followed the Chesapeake Bay, they could reach the Pacific Ocean. So yeah, as I say, there was a lot that they didn't know at the time. Now, we're talking about, well, first the first name is Ponce de León, right? Establishing himself first in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, kind of an afterthought. Puerto Rico because a lot of people laid claim to that, right? Diego Colón the son of Christopher Columbus. Diego Colón thought that he had the right, and there was a royal right, and other people claimed the right, and the governor, Gonzalo Fernández de Oviedo, he's not the governor, he's the chronicler. He's the one who gave us his opinions of what was happening. He tried to give us history while it was still fresh. In any case, at least according to Oviedo, he thought that the real paradise was to the north. There was an island called Bimini, which had a fountain of youth, right? The famous fountain of youth. And Ponce de León was very happy to go in pursuit of this, especially because the Colón family were successfully able to exercise their right over where he was, Puerto Rico. And, Juan Ponce went north. He had been in charge of pacifying the natives, right? One of the things that they mention is his extensive use of dogs. Dogs were the secret weapon in Spanish pacification. Those dogs had no problem attacking and eating people. In one of the chronicles, you have page after page talking about one of the special fighting dogs. This was a special breed, the Alanos, right? The como mastín, an enormous attack dog that the locals believed were like jaguars. You know, they called them like Spanish jaguars, European jaguars. They compared them. A dog called Becerillo, who earned twice as much as the average pay of a musketeer. I'm sure the dog was fed on meat on a regular basis, right? They say that this particular dog was responsible for one third of the enemy losses. Now, in any case, Ponce de León decided that if he couldn't make it in Puerto Rico, he would go north to Florida. There he died without finding the Fountain of Youth and without leaving any particular imprint on the colony, right? Later on, nobody really wanted to go up there. They still were not convinced that it wasn't an island. They still, again, the notions of geography were basic at that time. On another program, I talked about 1539, when Hernando de Soto, right, veteran of Peru, someone who had known Pizarro, Hernando de Soto, with 600 men, 200 horses, tried to establish himself in Florida with a notable lack of success, and they wanted to go home. The man who's, you know, the first European to see the Mississippi, going through Florida, what is Georgia today? What is Mississippi? What is Louisiana? What is Texas? Going from bad to worse, right? In the end, De Soto died, and the few survivors that remained built kind of, brigantino, like rafts, I don't know, balsas. And after a terrible, terrible ordeal of coastal navigation, trying to get back to Mexico, they couldn't get very far from the coast, right? Because their boats wouldn't allow them. And next to the ghost, at least according to the reports, there were almost constant war canoes coming out, and arrows, and it was hostility all the way down the coast. Finally, when they arrived, it was, what, only a fragment, only a small, small number of the people who had left. And there was no El Dorado. There was no third civilization comparable to the Aztecs or the Incas in North America. But you can still hope. In any case, yeah, there were missions in 1549. There was a mission that was immediately wiped out. That was the end. And in 1557, Santa Elena, a place called Santa Elena, was established. But it did not do well. Did not do well. Meanwhile, Florida was being used by the pirates. This was a very, very good place to attack the Spanish fleet, the treasure fleet, right? They were going in convoys on a regular basis and were susceptible to attack. Also, Florida was wide open for the French. At that time, the Spaniards were very, very worried. This is the 16th century. In the 17th century, it might be the English, but the 16th century, it is the French, the great enemies. They have already established themselves, and in 1565, the nightmare, a group of Huguenots, French Protestants, established a colony called Fort Caroline. And at this point, leaving them alone was not an option. At this point, passivity was not an option. Spain was going to have to be proactive, even if they didn't want to, even if Florida did not have an El Dorado or a Fountain of Youth or any real intrinsic value that could make a colony self-supporting. The Spaniards still had to act. Because if you open the door a little bit and let a group of harmless French Protestants establish a colony there, then who knows? In a couple of years, you're going to have a real problem. So, they completely wiped out the French colony, killed everybody they could. Men, women, and children, and then established St. Augustine, or San Agustin, and San Augustine, as it's often known. San Augustine is still the very first inhabited, the place, the oldest place in the United States, what is today the United States. And of course, the Spanish authorities recognize that if you're going to do it, if you're going to eliminate a French colony that's already there and establish a Spanish colony, you have to do it right. So yeah, 2,646 people under Pedro Méndez de Avilés, and they established themselves thinking, well, at least Méndez wrote to the king saying that the future of Florida will be of little expense and will pay your majesty much money and will be of more value to Spain than New Spain. Talking about what is today Mexico, right? Then New Spain, or even Peru, Yeah. And if you believe that, and it may be said that this country is but an annex of Spain, because it does not take more than 40 days to come here, and usually equally many to return. Yeah, wildly optimistic, telling people back in Madrid what they obviously want to hear. I guess that is how you get promoted to looking after a colony in the first place. In any case, they didn't do well. They didn't do well at all. There were some friendly natives, and there needed to be some friendly natives if the colony was going to survive. The fact is that they were living because of the food provided by these natives. Now, after this colony, after this town was established, you got the Franciscans. The Franciscan missionaries, they began to establish missions through the Georgia coast, inland, and unlike missions in other places, much closer, right, closer to the center, closer to the metropolis, closer, in this case, closer to Mexico City, these were not protected. In some cases, the Franciscans refused protection. Right? They didn't want soldiers. They said soldiers are always a bad influence on the natives. We don't want natives to see what soldiers do. Right? Or who they are. Or what they act like. No. We would much rather be role models in the process of Christianization. This presented an extreme problem because the local natives, most of them were not sedentary, right? Other places, yes, you have establishments, you have homes, cities, but one of the missionaries, this one a Jesuit, said that in order to obtain fruit in the souls, the blind, sad souls of these people, it is necessary that they come together and live in towns and cultivate the earth. It says, we must not do this by force, as the Lord commands. We must not use force in order to do this. And first, because they have been accustomed to live the way they are living for thousands of years. And secondly, that even if they were to do this, the soil is bad and it will be quickly exhausted. All right? It's easy to see that the man writing this is a Jesuit, thinking ahead, right? Unless this is done, although religion remains among them for 50 years, they will have no more fruit than we in our 4 years among them, which is none at all, nor even a hope, nor even a chance of a hope. So yes, these extremely negative comments contrasted, these extremely negative ecclesiastical comments contrasted very highly with the glowing recommendations of the civil authorities, right, saying that Florida will give, provide as much money to the royal treasury as Peru. You can imagine, the two are incompatible, but of the two, The one you should trust is the ecclesiastical opinion. And yes, where the Jesuits didn't want to go, the Franciscans took over. The Franciscans took over from the Jesuits. And, well, it was going to be a process. You know, in the, 100 years later, the Jesuits are completely, they were thrown out of Portugal, eliminated, thrown out of Spain, thrown out of the Spanish Empire. They have to go back to the Papal States. Refugees, hundreds and thousands of Jesuit refugees trying to get into the Papal States, and the Pope doesn't let them. And in the end, the Pope eliminates the Jesuit order. Right? Now, that was the end of the Jesuits until Napoleon. Right? After Napoleon, everybody wanted to forget the French Revolution, forget Napoleon, and they thought the best way to do that would be to reestablish the Jesuit order, right? The way to turn back the clock is to bring back the Jesuits, or at least that was the rationale used to reestablish the order after it had been eliminated. Now, in the Spanish Empire, yes, you had a systematic preference for the Franciscans. And here they were in Florida. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a few minutes.
Los profesionales de su empresa no comunican eficazmente en inglés, su empresa no necesita clases de inglés. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente. Muchas son las empresas españolas que despilfarran el dinero contratando clases de inglés a diestro y siniestro. Café para todos y resultados para nadie. Dominar el inglés requiere enfoque, esfuerzo y un plan. En Baugen Empresas tenemos un plan hecho a medida para su empresa. No nos interesa vender clases, nos interesa conseguir soluciones. Y para ello tenemos un apasionado equipo de profesores formados meticulosamente en el método Baugen. Llama al 911-335831, 911-335831. Su empresa necesita una solución y la necesita urgentemente.
Sin prisa pero sin pausa. This is the Spanish expression that I use when people ask me what they should do with their children concerning English. Sin prisa pero sin pausa. The target date for English mastery is age 23. Children and adolescents don't need English, really, until they reach adulthood, until they finish their studies and start looking for their first job. This is usually at the age of 23. If they don't know English well at this point, they are in trouble. They have a problem, an important problem. If they don't know English well at the age of 23, when they enter the labor market, they will probably never reach a decent level, a good working level of English. So, as a mother or father, you need to make sure that your children gain a good command of English by the age of 23 at the latest. This means that when the child is born, you have 23 years to solve the problem. Are you capable of solving a problem if you have a 23-year window to solve it? I hope so. Here in Vaughn Systems, we provide kids, children, with dynamic verbal access to English starting at the age of 4. We expose the children to the native sound of the language, and we work especially hard to promote effective listening comprehension and to make the language fun and attractive for the children. Entrust your children to us, little by little, slowly but surely, sin prisa pero sin pausa. We will transform them into bilingual adolescents and prepare them for age 23. Contact Vaughan Jr.
Más información sobre la línea Junior de Vaughan Systems en el teléfono 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
Atención, tenemos muy buenas noticias para ti. Ahora nuestro EMIP, el Executive Master en Inglés Profesional, también lo podrá realizar a mediodía, de lunes a viernes de 2 a 4 de la tarde. Aprovechate, llama al 91-133-5833. 91-133-5833. Nuestro EMIP, ahora también a mediodía. Si tienes alguna duda o necesitas información sobre cualquiera de nuestros cursos, llámanos al 91-133-5833. Repito, 91-133-5833.
Welcome back. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking about geopolitics. I was talking about North America, the southern part of North America, the coast, the original colonies, and how this was a borderland between the Spanish Empire and these different attempts, you know, by England to establish colonies in the North American coast. Everybody, at least initially, thinking that El Dorado was just around the corner, that, you know, there would be another civilization comparable to the Aztecs or comparable to the Actually, the Aztecs should be called the Mexica, right? The Mexica, that's the real name for Aztec. Aztec is a misnomer. It's a mistake. But everybody uses it, as so I have a tendency to use it when I don't actually mean that. The proper term is the Mexica. Well, the Mexica or the Inca. Now, there was no El Dorado, and there was no way this was going to be profitable, but it had to be there. As I mentioned, Florida for Spain was a terrible, terrible drain on the treasury, but it had to be there. So San Augustine was there because the English and the French and the Dutch and every pirate in the Caribbean and everybody had their eyes on Florida. It had to be Spanish. In the year 1606, the population of that little town was about 500, and they say that all 495 of those 500 people were being subvencionados, right? They were subsidized. They were there at the crown's expense. There were only five people in the entire colony that were paying for themselves, that were making their own living. Now, this was at a time when money was scarce, and there were other priorities. But Spain had to be there. Nobody wanted to be there. The governor of Cuba was complaining that you can't get people to go to Florida. You just can't. You have to force people to go to Florida. The only kind of person who wants to go to Florida is the kind of person who wants to escape. The kind of person who can't show his face in public, right? So, the low point was probably the beginning of the 18th century. Because at that point, they believed that an English attack was imminent. And so they sent a letter of panic, right, to the authorities. And the letter was believed. The local mayor applied for urgent help for 150 men, for cannon, for guns, for pikes, lances, anything, also money to repair the fortifications, to improve the defenses. And the English attack came. That money wasn't there. Too little too late. When it was finally done, when it was finally time to send people and reinforcements there, they say that they could only find 20 men, and those 20 men had to be put in chains, right? Encadenados. They had to be chained together in order to prevent them from running away, because they just did not want to go to Florida, considered at that time the worst place in the world. Now, one of the ways that the Spaniards were able to maintain such a large empire and have it, you know, the administration of that empire was not as bad as it could have been. I mean, all things considered, the administration went pretty well. Yes, you really have to complain about bureaucracy and about the paperwork and about the fact that you don't have entrepreneurs, but you have lawyers. And the only person who can get things done in the imperial system is a lawyer. And everything takes too long, and everything has to be checked and double-checked, and everything is much slower than it should be. Okay, yeah, you have the traditional complaints about such a large bureaucratic structure necessary to run an empire. But on the other hand, I mean, in terms of corruption, in terms of other things, you can say that, yes, this bureaucratic apparatus, this juggernaut, right, this huge machine, this colossus, that it asphyxiates initiative, right, nobody is thinking for themselves. Nobody is doing the right thing as they see it. No, everybody has to follow the rules and be brainless. Brainlessly following the rules. Okay, yeah, that complaint has been made. But at the same time, no, you don't have... The whole system ran pretty well for a very, very long time. One of the reasons was a special Spanish technique based on something the Romans did back in their empire, right? Spain had quite a bit of experience with the Roman Empire. When Spain had its empire in the New World, the Spanish aristocracy and the newly created letrados, right? People who had, not necessarily from noble families, who had studied in universities and knew how to get things done. Well, they were very, very familiar with the Roman way of doing things and what the Romans had done in Spain, and they self-consciously wrote about the administration of the empire in the Americas as being very much like the Roman Empire. So one of the techniques, right, again, benchmarking, you adopt the best practices. One of the techniques that they got from Roman law was the residencia. It's when you have somebody placed in a position of authority, you have a definite term of office, right? It ends. And so this person has been in charge for a specific amount of time, and now that person is going off to do something else. Well, at the end of that time, there is a visit, and it was called the visit. And the person making that visit was called the visitor. And so, and yeah, that was the that was the moment of truth, right? That was the acid test, right? The visitor inspects the books. And the visitor asks questions. The visitor does what is today called a 360-degree survey of everybody who might have dealings with this person to see whether the person has been honest, whether this person has been the kind of administrator that, gives credit to Spain. And if that wasn't true, then there was all sorts of things that the visitor could do, all sorts of punishment. But one of the main punishments was that the person's full salary was never paid during his term in office, right? You would have as much as one-third of your salary sort of waiting for you at the end of your term of office if the visitor said that everything had been clean, orthodox, above board. If the visitor gave the green light, if he gave his okay, then you would go off and do better things. But if the visitor didn't like what you had done, then, it was considered very bad. Well, visitors in Florida. Okay, first of all, I mentioned this earlier. The civil authorities and the ecclesiastic authorities never got along, right? And there were always mutual accusations, really, really bad blood between especially the Franciscans in the missionaries and the local governor. In many cases, certainly in the case of one Francisco del Moral Sanchez, the Franciscans accused him of being in collusion with smugglers, contrabandistas, right? And this was a very common accusation, very easy to make. The entire, you could write a history of North America with smuggling as its leitmotif, right? As the underlying theme. The War of American Independence, right? The creation of the United States was in part about smuggling, about a way of avoiding taxes. Taxes considered reprehensible, restrictions on free trade considered intolerable. Right? This is what the Boston Tea Party was about. This is one of the big reasons why people were convinced that the North American colonies would have to leave the empire. Well, very much the same in Spanish colonies around the, pretty much everywhere, right? At one point, after the War of Spanish Secession, right, after the Treaty of Utrecht, the Spanish Empire lost the asiento de negros, the exclusive right to slaves and the slave trade from Africa, and they lost the exclusive right to trade their own material, right? So the British had the right to send ships, a certain amount of cargo, pre-established by treaty, a pre-established amount of cargo, which, of course, the British did not respect. right? They sent much more, much, much more. They sent, you know, ships and more ships and more ships. And of course, what they didn't send, the pirates had, right? And so, the whole idea of contraband was just ridiculous at that point, right? The first couple of years of the 18th century, the mid 18th century, the idea that ship has already sailed, it's far too late. You can't do a thing about it. But both in the case of England and in the case of Spain, they were trying. And in this case, in 1735, the Franciscans were claiming that in San Agustin, you could only find English goods, that people were wearing English clothes, that they were sitting on English furniture. But you can imagine, because of the bureaucracy, it meant that the legitimate goods had to be shipped from Spain to Havana to New Spain and then brought to Florida, whereas in Florida, the locals were complaining that people were dying of hunger, starving, and that soldiers who had not been paid were reduced to begging, right? Mendigos. And that widows and orphans had no way, nobody to look after them, right? How is the town going to survive except through contraband? Now, this was an easy accusation to make. And the local governor, Francisco del Moral Sánchez, Mr. del Moral, understood that the visit was coming up, right? And the visitor was, the arrival of the visitor was imminent. And he just completely lost every calm. He began to arrest citizens. He imprisoned people for criticizing him. The crown had to intervene and replace him. That's it. Otherwise, of course, if he was the physical face of the Spanish administration in the town, that would have meant that none of the locals would have collaborated or would have agreed to follow the rules. And so you have the perfect combination of isolation, impotence, paranoia, the problem of supplying a colony like this that by logic shouldn't exist, but through geopolitics must exist. And of course, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right? There's no way you can please everyone. So, for example, the following administrator, right? Just a couple of years later, decided that this had gone on long enough, and he was going to, the word we use is to crack down. To crack down is to begin to enforce the rules, right? Hacer cumplir, to enforce, but in a very, very strict way. With no tolerance, no mercy, to stop looking the other way, to stop turning a blind eye on this kind of corruption. So, to crack down. And he decided, whose name was Alonso Fernández de Heredia, and he decided to crack down. And he discovered that the fishing ships were actively involved in trading with the enemy, Charleston, right, in Carolina, just in the north, with these people who had come from Barbados. And they could sell Spanish tobacco and Spanish sugar for a price that was cheaper than the locals could get it themselves, right? And then they could resell it to England. And they were making a profit, and the people in San Agustin were making a profit. And as I say, he cracked down. He used 60 soldiers and was able to incautar, right, to seize something like, an enormous amount. Let's put it that way. Huge amount of money and a huge amount of contraband tobacco and sugar. His victims, to put it that way, sought sanctuary with the Franciscans, right? They thought that the church would give them sanctuary, and the Franciscans were only too happy to allow these people to be in the church. Well, the local governor broke protocol and had these people removed from the church by force. And as I say, you can't please anyone. You're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. Another saying in English, no good deed, ninguna buena hazaña, no good deed. Deed comes from do, and it is una hazaña. It's used, it has a very special use, right? No good deed goes unrewarded, right? Cada buena hazaña tiene su recompensa. That is the normal expression. But we generally use this ironically. We generally change it around. And we say, no good deed goes unpunished. In other words, cada buena hazaña tiene su castigo. Right? Or va sin castigo, goes unpunished. So yeah, we actually use this a lot. When you're trying to do the right thing and you get in trouble for doing the right thing, this happens a lot. It happens to everyone. And in English, we do say, no good deed goes unpunished. Well, that is the case of Alonso Fernández de Heredia, because after he cracked down, he realized that he had made a great number of enemies. Enemies in Madrid, enemies in the Council of Indies, enemies in the church, and no friends, right? There was absolutely no incentive for doing the right thing, for doing his job. Now, another expression in English, show me the incentive and I will show you the outcome. If there is no incentive to do your job correctly, then the outcome will be that people do not do their job correctly. And of course, there was a difference between the empire and the absolute chaos, which were the English colonies in North America. For example, nobody ever tried to prevent shipbuilding from being important in the different colonies. The different colonies, they began shipbuilding, and obviously the access to so much cheap wood. That began to be a big deal. Whereas In the Spanish Empire, that was all regulated. Obviously, there were shipyards, astilleros. There were shipyards in, especially in Havana, right? There were very important ones. But still, local initiative was discouraged. I mean, you needed a permit to be able to do that, right? Practically the only thing that was discouraged in the British colonies, in the North American colonies, was weapons, right? Arms manufacture, gun factories. That was actively discouraged, right? And there was even some control of metal. In comparison, in the Spanish Empire, well, they wanted, especially after the reforms during the Bourbon times, right? In the time of Enlightenment, mercantilism. For example, at one point, they wanted all of the New World to be dependent on Spanish wine. So they would have to purchase Spanish wine. Well, there wasn't enough Spanish wine. Spanish wine was practically unaffordable, which meant that the Americas never really developed a taste for wine. Even today, yes, there are great wine-making regions there, but if you go to most of the Spanish-speaking world, wine is not on the menu. All right, I seem to have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please, listen to my next program.
Estás escuchando Vaughn Radio.